Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
You're listening to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you in-depth and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway and beyond. I'm your host, Variety's theater editor, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'll be talking to the actor Jamie Parker. You may not know his name, but you certainly know the name of the character he's playing on Broadway, the boy wizard Harry Potter, all grown up and appearing as one of the lead characters in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Parker, previously on Broadway as part of the original cast of the History Boys, won an Olivier Award for his performance as Harry on the West End, and now he and several other members of the London cast have apparated onto Broadway, where the show is in previews ahead of an April 22nd opening, and has already become a ticket so hot it rivals Hamilton. Jamie's here in the studio with me to talk about tackling an iconic role, interacting with the Potterverse superfans, and acting for Broadway audiences versus West End crowds. Hey, Jamie, thanks for being here.
Hello, thanks for having me.
How's Broadway treating you?
Brilliant.
Yeah?
It's it's great. It's about 12 years since I've been here.
Yeah.
And it's changed.
It's a different place.
Changed a lot. You guys have got protected bike lanes now and the city bike scheme, and it's all like, you know, we've all gone very Berlin.
Are you a city biker yet?
I am. I've been pretty lazy about it lately, but just because we're in the thick of the heaviest part of the schedule, but
right.
Now it's the only way to get around. Love New York. Very, very happy to be back.
Do you notice a difference between the Broadway audiences and the West End audiences?
A bit. I mean, this is an unusual project because it's a global audience. You know,
it was like a crowd. When I saw it in London, it was like an international crowd.
Yeah,
like
you go on the stage door and you meet people from Paraguay and Texas and Australia and Indonesia and just you name it. I met one family who'd come on en masse from Mexico to see the show, but they didn't have tickets. They didn't have tickets for the show, but they turned up just hoping that they'd be able to chance their arm and get in. They didn't get in.
Oh, man.
And they had to fly back to Mexico without having gone in. You know, which was
sad story.
On the extreme end of the sort of global pilgrimage that it is. But it, just to say that, you know, every day that's the mix. And obviously, like, there's a sort of default of London character in London, and New York is definitely bouncier.
Are we?
Yeah. Are you kidding? Yeah. pretty much. The difference is, I mean, like, in London, when they see something that they think is amazing, they go, oh. And here, you see something that blows your mind, you guys go, what? And just openly ask questions really loudly. Which is brilliant. And especially for us, it's like, you know, we feel like we're in Friends or something.
Right. You know. And so how long were you in Cursed Child in London? How long did you do it?
A year. We all did a year.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And what did you learn from that run that you're now using here in New York?
Good question. I learned that it's a play that, in Michael Gambon's words, has legs, which means that you don't... It's really all that you're hoping for. Obviously, combined with an audience that is willfully credulous enough to make the play take flight, but you want to have a play that has its own legs, which means that you don't have to be generating something out of nothing. It has its own momentum. It has its own kind of melting pot in it that means that you don't have to work too hard. You're hoping to get to that point where you don't have to be doing the work per se with the play, and we've got that because Jack has mined these complex and difficult and long-standing relationships.
The writer, yeah. Playwright, yeah.
He's mined all of these complicated and long-standing relationships and put them under some pretty juicy crises. And that just means that you can... I mean, we've done upwards of 200 times around the whole story now, I think, in front of an audience, and every time is different. Obviously, there's a consistency to it. It's still the same play. It's still the same people. But you can read the same lines in infinite different ways.
Do you notice that your Harry now has changed from your Harry then?
Yeah, I think I probably do. Well, it's just that, like, I remember teaching our son to walk, and part of it is just the one step in front of another thing, and then occasionally you turn around and you go, look how far you've walked, just to give them encouragement. And so just inevitably, day by day, you make a long list of very, very small decisions and very small discoveries of new things. So I look back to a year ago or 18 months ago, and I think, man, there's so much that I didn't understand about the play, or hadn't realized, connections I hadn't made, or I felt like I was doing a very simplistic reading of something. Or sometimes you take a very circuitous route back to the blindingly obvious and revisit that. But if you're not slightly embarrassed by the person you were last year, then you're not growing at all, are you? It's the difference between theatre and film is you're not, it's not fixed. It's not in the can. Every go is a take.
Do you prefer doing it all in one day or breaking it up? What's your preference? Or do you have one?
No, more often than not, we do it all in one day, three times a week. There's only once in the week where...
What is that, Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday?
Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday, we do it all
and
in
then
a day.
Thursday, Friday is part one, part two.
Yeah, you can do a Thursday night part one, Friday night part two combination. What I do notice is that the Thursday night part one is generally pretty bouncier, because if you're starting, everyone's finished work, right. At that point, or it's not the weekend, and then so you're not they've been awake for longer, you've possibly had a drink before you start the show, as opposed to the matinee where you start in a slightly bouncier place on a Thursday night. Sometimes, not all the time. The only thing I find slightly odd is sometimes jumping straight in with part two on a Friday night, because you get taken there by the hands all the way to act four in the course of a day, and you just sort of ride that momentum. Whereas you're still
this
jumping
is, and you're, what you're calling act four is the second half of part two. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Play two, act two.
Right.
So we just call them act one, two, three,
sure.
and four.
Each because it is one story. It's not. There's no. They do not stand alone. They don't even. They make no effort to stand alone, right?
No, yeah. It's all the movie split, right. Deathly Hallows, one
right.
book into two parts, for the last one. So it's the same thing.
And so, tell us about your early involvement in the show. When did you first hear about the project? And how'd you get the part?
Compared with a lot of the rest of the sort of the central nucleus of the cast, I'm quite late to the party. Most of the guys were involved at some point, in the workshops that they did when they were still developing it and finding a vocabulary for it and figuring out where it was going to go. I wasn't. So the first thing I knew about it at all was late 2015. Is that right? Yes, 2015.
Right, it opened in 2016, as I recall, in the summer, yeah.
I'm losing track of the timeline. I was doing a completely different show. I was doing Guys and Dolls in London. We were out of town.
Who were you playing?
I was Skye Masterson.
Skye, yeah, okay.
Quite different from Harry Potter.
Yes.
But we were out of town for a couple of weeks waiting to come into the West End. And I got a call saying, in principle, would you be interested in Harry Potter in the West End? And I'll admit, I was fairly virgin territory when it came to Harry Potter. I'd read the first book, and I'd seen the first three movies, but I wasn't, I wasn't at the party, so I didn't understand the question particularly. I didn't know if it was a musical, which it patently isn't,
right.
But it's a question that a lot of people asked. I didn't know which part, because I didn't know that the final book finished 19 years later and that they were going to be picking up the story from there.
Did they? So, well, they must have known that by then, I guess.
Well, they did, but that wasn't part of the brief when it was asked about
it. They wouldn't have told you that yet.
But I said which part, and they said Harry, and I was like, okay. Because last time I was here, I was in History Boys.
Right.
And I was a fully grown man in a school uniform. And I sort of had visions of being in a school uniform again for a long period of time. I thought, surely I'm getting a bit past it to do that now. There was a lot that was surprising and I didn't know. And I didn't know which team was behind it. But the moment I saw Sonny Friedman and Colin Callender's names at the top of the list, and the fact that
they're two major producers,
they're producing the show, and then the creative team, you know, half of which I'd worked with before, people like Neil Austin, who's the lighting designer,
right,
who's extraordinary, Martin Lowe, who on handling the music, and then you've got John Tiffany and Stephen Hoggett, who, you know,
the director and movement. What do we call Stephen in this? Is he a movement choreographer?
The movement director or the choreographer.
Right.
And John Tiffany, the director. But both of whom, you know, their work speaks for itself. It's extraordinary. They're all people I would take a project blind for them. I would say yes to a job to work with this creative team without knowing what the part or the project was. Give anything to work with them. So, and the clincher was seeing Jack Thorne's name working on the script, because he's responsible for co-writing arguably the best TV miniseries I've ever seen of This Is England.
I don't think as many people know that here.
I mean, you know, but suffice it to say, he's an extraordinary writer, and I knew exactly who he was, and I knew I would want to work with anything that he'd written. So I said, of course, I'll read it. But there was a thick veil of secrecy over the entire thing, obviously. So I had to come down from out of town into London.
Did you read the whole thing? Well, like, did they give you the whole script?
Read it? They said, either we bring a script to Birmingham, so there'll be like a security corps guy in a helmet with a bat and a gun. Well, so, not really, but you know.
I mean, maybe. You don't know.
But basically have to sit under supervision reading it. So and then it was all like a watermark script and everything. And or you come down to London. So I said, well, I need to come down to London anyway. So I came down for the weekend, went to Sonia's office, signed a non-disclosure agreement, and sat in a very small room for 4.5 hours with 250 pages worth of early draft. It was moved on a lot since the play text that we've got now.
And when did you meet J.K. Rowling, and did she have any advice?
I didn't meet her before I had the role. My readings for it were put on tape and sent up to Edinburgh, so she must have approved it, I suppose. Yep. And the first time I met her was in London when we were rehearsing.
Did you solicit any advice? Was there any thought of, oh, this woman's got some insight that I might need?
I didn't solicit it because I thought there was a confidence about the way John and Sonia told and Jack told the story of them getting the chance to helm this installment of the story in the first place. You know, she's had a lot of offers from people who wanted to do the next installment. She turned all of them down. And
you're talking about J.K. Rowling getting a lot of offers to do some sort of theater event or a film or whatever.
An arena sort of magic-a-thon kind of thing, or a musical or whatever. And she'd always said no. And so there was an inherent confidence in the fact that we were being allowed to do this, and an implicit trust on her part about putting hands up and saying, I'm not a theatre practitioner. I know I want this story to be told in this medium, but I'm not an expert in this field. I'm going to trust you guys to do your job. So I counted myself as part of that family, and I said, okay, the understanding is if I'm going wrong, she'll set me right. But she's written the blueprint through 7 volumes of backstory, which is pretty handy.
You don't get that for most roles, do you?
No, you don't. Yeah. So I'm going to get on with my job, and if I'm going wrong, they'll tell me. And
how much did did you watch the movies and think about Daniel Radcliffe's performance at all? Did that factor in at all, or is this an entirely different Harry?
I've seen them, and Daniel's giving his own entirely empathetic interpretation of the source material, but it would be incomplete and perhaps inaccurate of me to take the movies as the source material. So I'm not consciously trying to emulate or imitate Daniel Radcliffe's performance. That wouldn't serve. That, as I say, that would be incomplete. So I always went back to the books. So I'm having been a newbie, I'm now on my fifth or sixth time through the books. I've lost count, to be honest.
Fifth or sixth. What do you gain from rereading them?
Detail. I mean, that
it, still it's, after.
Yeah, that I realized only about 2 or 3 weeks ago, listening to the audiobooks as I was cycling through the city, and went and heard a line in Goblet of Fire that's echoed in the play, and I went, how have I only just noticed that now? Like, after an entire year's contract in London, it's, you know, it just small things. Sometimes they'll just be like a pairing of two words together that also occurs in the play or something, and it's the most minor sort of fading echo of something, but it has an association. And it's not irrelevant. It all feeds in. It gives you something new to think about over the course of, because it's a long run. You can't if you're just stuck in performance mode, you're not growing. You need to keep looping back into a rehearsal mindset. And when you've got so much source material that you can't possibly ever have mined all of it, then you just keep digging around, and you're always going to stir something up and find something new. It's helpful.
As you thought about aging this character up, in your view, what was Harry like as a teenager, and how did that influence the kind of adult that he is?
Hardened, tempered through experience, but ultimately still a child. So there's this exoskeleton which he's acquired through his experience, and it's still in place. And the requirement from him now as a parent is to be able to show what's underneath that armor, because you can't be armored. I mean, you must be forewarned and armed and have the tools to be a parent, but you can't go into parenthood as a battle and expect to win.
We should say that the story is very much about one of the central relationships is the relationship between Harry and his son.
Yes, that's the sort of main meal of the right. of the drama. Right. Obviously, it's far-reaching and complex and many faceted. But that's the main bit of it. And so that becomes the question of, you know, when somebody becomes cauterized somewhere in the between the goalposts of 11 and 17. And then is then faced with being a parent, hits 40 and realizes that he's now twice the age that his father was when he died, and has had to make up parenthood for the last 2 decades as he goes along, without even a surrogate father, because they've all died or left him or been manifestly not a decent role model. That's what he's learning, finding, scraping around for. Help me.
How'd you discover acting? When did you come to it?
I grew up watching my family take part in amateur stuff. So I did have very early experiences of...
Where was this?
This was in the northeast of England, as a mid-sized town called Darlington.
I noted that you were born in Cleveland and thought, that's surprising, and then realized, not that Cleveland.
a small area of the northeast, sort of Billy Elliot kind of country.
Right.
So I got very young, very early memories of being in a very beautiful theatre. The Darlington Civic Theatre is gorgeous, but, you know, that night and day stark transition of going from the sort of red and gold brocades of the house and then through the access door to the side of the proscenium arch and going backstage and seeing, you know, the ropes of the fly gallery and the dust and the prompt corner and going back to the dressing rooms and stuff. So that's always made it feel like home. But it couldn't get me on stage. I wouldn't go anywhere near it until I just turned 12. I was barely out of being 11 when I got on a train and went up to a boarding school in the middle of Scotland with my little round glasses. And
little round Harry Potter glasses?
Yeah, I did, believe it or not. Yeah. And this was the 90s as well. She was, you know, she and I used to hang out in the same... So the reports are that J.K. Rowling used to write in a place called Nicholson's and the Elephant House and the Travis Theatre Bar, all three of which were places that I used to go to during those years. But I didn't have black hair or green eyes. No. You know, read into that what
and
you
still
want.
Don't, actually.
And still don't, no. But, you know, you go to boarding school and you have to find a new family and a new sense of belonging. And I found it through theatre.
Are there any roles that are on your bucket list?
The list has got shorter because I've had an extraordinary decade in which I've had a chance to do a few of them.
You did. I noticed that you played Prince Hal through all three of the Shakespeare, the Henry 4 and 5 plays.
Yeah. I mean, which was mega for me. The first play I ever saw that transported me from start to finish was Henry V. And it was decidedly, and it was always very specific because of the Olivier film. It was always very specifically in an Elizabethan playhouse with groundlings and oak boards and pillars and the three lions and the fleur-de-lis. But back then, Shakespeare's Globe on Bankside in London didn't exist. The reconstruction hadn't got going.
Right.
So it was a very weird day in my early 30s to find myself tacking in Henry V wearing that thing in the Elizabethan playhouse in London. And to, you know, have got to do Prince Hal leading up to it. And there have been others, you know, Guys and Dolls was one of them. Cat Not Tin Roof and stuff like that. The only one I missed, there was an outside chance of doing Journey's End, but I didn't get it, and I'm now too old for that role. So, there's one more, but I won't say what it is because, if it's supposed to happen, it'll happen.
Let's finish with your advice to theatergoers. How much of Harry Potter's story do you need to know going into Harry Potter and the Cursed
Child?
Don't
need to know any of it. I genuinely believe that. You don't need to do that. And I know that, apart from else, because I've met a lot of people who have come to see it who aren't Potterheads and they don't know anything about it. But it's replete with Easter eggs for people, for the fans, and you know you will find yourself sitting in there, and the entire theatre will go and you'll go what? I don't understand.
But there are not. It should be said there are not a huge number of those moments where don't know who don't know like a name drop. You're not going to feel excluded often. Right?
Yeah, but the good news is that will make you want to go and find out.
Right.
And go, why was that such a big deal?
What do for people who haven't read the books or haven't seen any of the movies, don't know the story at all, what do they respond to, do you think?
Well, hopefully, if it doesn't sound too pompous, just that being part of something that exceeds the sum of its parts. I think that's the joy of a decent piece of theatre, is you kind of go, well, it's just cloaks and it's just props and costumes, and yet somehow this seems to have added up to something more significant than that. More impactful than you might expect could be possible from such kind of ragged foils, as Shakespeare puts it. Certainly there are entrances of so hard not being able to tell you what happens, but
you can't say a lot, can you?
There are moments when certain figures make their entrances where if all you've ever seen is movies, you will understand that no movie will ever be able to compete with the effect that it has in the room when those entrances happen, because it's happening in the same room. In London, I did once see a woman just get up and run. One entrance happened, and she was on the aisle. She was on the center aisle, and she just got up and ran.
But then she missed the rest of the story.
Yeah, well,
maybe she hung out in the back.
It's quite near the end, anyway. So, there are, you just come and see it.
Yeah,
you've got to be in the room,
And we'll leave it with that.
Okay.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very
much. Nice to talk to you.
Take care.
Thank you.
was Broadway's Harry Potter, Jamie Parker, now starring in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child at the Lyric Theater. On the next episode of Stagecraft, I'll talk to Captain America himself, Chris Evans, the actor who's currently earning glowing reviews in his Broadway debut in the Kenneth Lonergan play, Lobby Hero. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.